Hello and welcome to Roll for Topic. I'm Chris Salzman. This week we have the audio for you from the Ann Arbor District Library's GameCon that happened about a week and a half ago or so that Andy and I were on a panel with Phil Cameron as well, just kind of talking about like, you know, how to GM, right? Like, so we're answering questions from the audience as well as the moderator, Christopher Becker. Yeah, it was super fun, and we wanted to just share this with you in case you weren't able to make it to the con. If you're interested, you can also watch the video from this panel as well. It's posted on the AADL's YouTube channel, which we'll try to have a link to that in the show notes. But yeah, it was a super good time. I am very thankful if any of you were there and are listening to this. I really appreciate everybody's just like, yeah, their questions, how engaged they were. It was amazing. I am just forever amazed at like the generosity and like the wisdom that comes from other people that run games. So yeah, go ahead, give us a listen, and we will be back with a regularly scheduled episode in a few weeks.
Hello, everybody. We're so happy to see you all today at the game convention at the Ann Arbor District Library. It's going to be a great day, and we've got some great panel discussions up here on the fourth floor all day. So my name's Christopher, and I'm here with Audrey and Marissa. Audrey's downstairs. If you have any questions about anything, you can let any staff members know. But I am particularly delighted to welcome three friends and three longtime veterans of gaming in Ann Arbor, Phil Cameron, and we've got Chris Salzman and Andy Rao here. I'm going to let them introduce themselves, talk a little bit about what games they play, ask a few hardball questions, turn it over to you, and then I've got more questions if you don't. So I think we'll just begin. Thank you so much. And could you please help me welcome them to the panel discussion? Thank you. Cool.
Thank you all. Before I tell you about my gaming history, I'd like to acknowledge that we are on the land that was ceded in the Treaty of Detroit in 1807. The Ann Arbor District Library is on the land of the Anishinaabe people and the Huron tribe. It's important to recognize that. That tribe still exists. There's this really awesome solar punk exhibit at the UMMA, actually, called Future Cache by... her name is, I took notes, Andrea Carlson is the person, the artist that did that. And like I said, she doesn't call it solar punk, but it imagines decolonized futures.
Cool.
So UMMA, it's free. It's worth checking out. Last week, 3 weeks ago, I played a game called Eat the Reich, which is a game where you play vampires tasked with drinking all of Hitler's blood. It's available for pre-order. That was the last game. What was the other question, Chris?
Just to introduce yourself. Yeah,
and then I think I've done enough.
It's a phenomenal introduction to Phil right there. Yeah, I'm Chris Salzman. I am one half of the Roll for Topic podcast, so Andy over here is also part of it. So that's how we have sort of gotten connected with a lot of people here. I play lots of different styles of game. Every once in a while, you'll catch me playing Dungeons & Dragons. I think the most recent game that I played a one-shot of Mouse Ritter, which is a really fun game where you pretend to be small mice. A couple of the players are actually here from that. So that was super fun. But I'm really interested in just sort of like games as a way to bring your friends together to have fun together. So.
Yeah, I'm Andy Rao. Co-host with Chris of our podcast, and I guess I snuck in. I'm not actually from Ann Arbor. I'm from Grand Rapids, yeah. So if I have to leave, that's okay. That's my symbol. I started playing role-playing games back in the 80s, so I've been here forever. And these days, I have a kind of long-running game of Call of Cthulhu that I run for some of my family members. I just started an online game of Band of Blades.
Nice.
And in about a week, I have to run D&D for a bunch of 13-year-old boys.
We'll be talking about that for the remainder of the hour.
So yeah. Send help.
It'll be delightful.
Wonderful. So let me start with a kind of big overall question about your philosophy of gaming, if you might have one. I don't think you have it written out, but you may have it subconsciously in your head. There are a lot of ideas about what RPGs are. Some people call them collective storytelling. I'm not sure that always fits the case. Every time I get together to game, or even when I've seen the three of you game, it's not always collective storytelling. Sometimes things happen that you don't want to happen, and that may not be so collective. So if you have any kind of an idea of what you, how you approach gaming with your friends or with your players, I'd love to hear that.
Are we all going to defer to each other every time?
I went first last time.
Okay, yeah. I can start. I think, like I mentioned sort of my intro, like for me, it's all sort of about the fun that you're having. So I do really like collective storytelling when it comes down to it. I do also like taking control now and then and saying, like, this is where the story is going, too, because I think that can be helpful for groups to have something to sort of bounce off of when you're doing it. So for me, it's whenever you're playing games with your friends, you know, you're agreeing to a set of rules that you're going to use to have that fun together, and I think that's totally okay to have mechanics. The point where the mechanics start to get in the way of that is when you need to say, let's stop, we can put those aside, let's just kind of rule of cool this, right? We can kind of keep playing from there. So, like, that's the philosophy that I bring to it. I think for me it is way more about the narrative than, say, min-maxing character sheets.
Yeah, I think I have a similar approach to Chris. For me, gaming is primarily an excuse to get to people together with people I care about, and a sort of framework or set of restrictions we can put around ourselves to have a particular type of fun. I don't usually approach role playing games with the kind of metaphor of a story, although it's delightful when story occurs. The most fun I have with the game sessions I run are ones where I feel that together with people I enjoy spending time with, we have collectively sort of solved a puzzle or achieved a goal within the restrictions and constraints we've chosen to apply to ourselves, whether that's within the framework of a particular rule system or within the framework of a particular genre we want to emulate. I've had a lot of fun in the last year running games set in the Aliens and Star Trek universes because they come with such wonderful tropes to lean into. So when I feel like the table has a good game session is one that ends where I feel like we've all collectively like solved a puzzle or met a challenge.
Andy said it best with, I play games mostly to bring people that I care about together. That's a pretty important part of the game. But I'm also quite social. So the other part of the game is different. And I run public games. And I run, so like Adventurers League for Dungeons & Dragons is where you go and you just, anyone can come in, right? It's sort of like, it's the coffee house of games where you know that you're going to get an adventure that follows the D&D thing. Mm-hmm. And those games, when I play those, I care about those people, and I wouldn't do it if I didn't. But in those games, it's about empowering the people and helping them to see additional narratives based on the systems and then being able to take that memorableness back to their friends, right? And D&D is great for that. Many games are great for that, but the framework of D&D... Adventurers League is that you can give them a memorable moment that they can then go tell their friends about and spread that empowerment. Nice. So people I care about, empowering players.
So I've just got a follow-up question. Do your characters ever die in a session, and do they have an expectation that there's a safety net that you will change the outcome of the story or the game or massage the rules or fudge the dice so that that doesn't happen?
I'm too soft. So, yeah, I don't have a good answer to that. I think, yeah, for me, like talking about empowerment and stuff, like it's very hard for me to go super hard against characters, because I think another kind of part of my philosophy is like being fans of the characters, right? And for me, it's very hard to be a fan of a character and also say, well, welcome to your doom, right? Yeah.
So. Generally speaking, in the sort of longer, when I'm running a longer running campaign, character death usually doesn't happen very often or at all. And I think I do, however, really embrace player character death in games where that's really genre appropriate. So playing aliens, if you're playing in my game of aliens, you know, your character is very likely to die a bad death, right? And I run a lot of Call of Cthulhu, and death or insanity are things you should expect from the genre. I have run into trouble. The times where that's been a challenge has been when there's been a disconnect between what I assume the genre experience is going to be and what the players assume it will be. So, but yeah, I don't have a problem with player death, but it needs to add something, I think, rather than just simply punish a player or make them like to be the RPG equivalent of like losing your turn or something.
I play games where character death is important. Heart, the City Beneath is a role-playing game where your final level-up action takes you out of the game and just ends your character narrative really powerfully. The same thing is true. I killed Paul's character 3 weeks ago in Eat the Reich because that's kind of what you do. But again, there's a Blaze of Glory mechanic where you then get to like make a really indelible impact on the story, which is all just examples of what Andy was saying, that like if the genre and the conventions go for it, then yes. I don't think I've never killed anyone in a Dungeons & Dragons game, for example.
So do you tend to have a pre-scripted storyline and you're kind of, you know, railroading your characters through, or is it more of an open-ended sandbox? They can do anything they want, and you hope that they discover something fun to do that session.
I go with the trope is called the quantum troll, where like no matter where they end up, there's something that exciting that's going to happen. So like if you take a left in the hallway, then and this is in Theater of the Mind games, right? So. When you are playing purely mentally, you can change the map, and then your players can always run into something interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's generally how I play. So that said, there's a lot of fun to be had in sandbox games where you just lay out a map, and that map is pre-generated with just a bunch of cool stuff, and whatever your players see, they see. The Aliens games are good for that. So the Free League Aliens have like cinematic experiences where you get a sandbox and a mission, and then you can go out and like you can run those 3 or 4 times, even though they're one shots, because there's so many different paths that the players can like go through them. Yeah. I would encourage, if you are a GM in the audience and you make a sandbox, just run it again. Change some names. Like you've done like 8 hours of work, and if it's play at the play away from the table, fine, right?
Yeah.
Like if you enjoy doing that, great. But there's no reason not to rerun the same thing. Rotate your map 90 degrees, change the coloring.
No one will know.
Yeah. No one will know. And they will not go through the same experience because they're going to be playing different characters and they're different people from that moment. So, sandboxes.
I've run all games that run the gamut. I've run railroady adventure paths, and I've run more open sandboxy ones. I think my ideal environment is a sandbox with tight constraints. So my mind also went to the Aliens RPG because, like in a game like Aliens or another sci-fi game like that, you can impose tight constraints. Like you're on the space station or the spaceship, you can't leave it. So there's a limit on your sandbox. I know that there's a level of roaming that the PCs will not be able to do. So I don't have to map out the solar system in case they decide to become like traders flying from planet to planet or something like that. But then I really try very hard not to assume one solution to problems. One of the great joys of role playing, I think, is as the GM not knowing how the players will solve a problem I put in front of them. And if I myself have not pre-solved that problem, it's all the more delightful when they use, but then you do have the responsibility to fill the environment with enough things for them to engage with that they'll be able to come up with something. And they always come up with something.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they always come up with something early like that. I think I'm discovering as we're talking that the Aliens RPG is actually really good. Yeah. So you should maybe go check that out. Because I've played Andy ran a game of that. And I just found it absolutely delightful because you had the sense of, you know, there is a sandbox, but there's also like a ticking timer, right? And I think that's sort of the way to make a sandbox really work is you have to have a world that is going to continue on sort of without the player's interaction with it. But to get back to what Christopher was asking initially, for me, I really like to have like sort of story beats that I really want to hit. So I have nothing against trains. I like railroads and stuff like that. So I'm fine having like we're going to hit these four or five story beats. And sort of in between there, I don't really care what happens other than there are problems, you're going to solve them and, you know, in your own creative ways. And I often, as a sort of challenge to myself to sort of step back and release some control that I might want to keep, I will try to put those scenarios in there where it's like, I don't know what Andy was saying. Like, I don't know what's going to happen here. I know they're going to solve the problem, and I'm just going to kind of see what happens, and we'll roll with it. And that can be really fun because, again, you're sort of seeing what gets generated at the table, and that's just like, I mean, that's the reason to play these games, I think.
Yeah, it is funny. Players do always surprise you. And I know we joke about that, but it happens every single time.
Yeah.
I just want to say if anyone has a question, just raise your hand. I'd be happy to come around with the mic. If not right now, I've got lots more questions. Yeah,
I actually had a question. Yeah, for everybody here, who all runs games here? Can you just like show of hands? Okay.
Oh, good.
Maybe I should have asked, like, who doesn't run games here? Yeah. Okay, that's cool. Yeah, that's really good to know. Cool.
Great. So you've mentioned Aliens a few times. I never buy any proprietary pre-made world system. I think it's because my imagination is so stuck on the story that I already know exists. You know, I think I'd have trouble coming up with something original in Aliens, or if I'm buying, a Lord of the Rings story, it's like, I don't know, they've just got to get rid of the ring, you know?
Yeah.
How do you all feel about proprietary world games, and how do you give your players something unexpected?
Our friend Nate actually put it really well around that. So Eat the Reich is a really focused like one shot, and there is a campaign for Aliens, but what we're talking about right now are they're called cinematic experiences, mm-hmm. Which are standalone products. You don't even need to buy the rule book to play the cinematic Alien experiences. And again, there's enough in there to like, I'm excited to run it for a third time. Mm-hmm. But they are essentially like board games, right? So if you think of them more as a board game where you know what you're doing coming into it, it's still a good reason to get people you care about together. Mm-hmm. And it's a very specific kind of experience that you're having. So mm-hmm. from that perspective, I really like the proprietary stuff, mm-hmm. I would say. Comment? No, I'd love to hear what the audience has.
It's on. So I run a number of games. The most recent proprietary game that I've run was actually the Mistborn adventure game from Trendy. And as a huge fan of everything Brandon Sanderson, I found it interesting to run a game, but instead of setting it during the time period of the books themselves, I set it like 3 or 4 years before the first book begins.
Nice, yeah.
And there is so much rich world building that there's so much stuff you can do within that world that hasn't even been touched on yet because there's so much world and even universe building within there mm-hmm. that you can do all sorts of things completely unrelated to the main story of the books.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, I think like, yeah, whenever you're running something proprietary like that, right, you get the chance to sort of like, you know, focus on the thing that you're really interested in. You know, as part of it. And I think, like, so we mentioned genre, I think, a few times up here. And I think, like, that's the way to run something proprietary is, like, you're getting a group of friends together that want to do something in that genre. So I played a Lord of the Rings campaign. A friend was running it, and we were the bumbling hobbits, right? Like, that was the whole pitch was, like, you are going to play as hobbits, and we're going to have this, like, kind of bumbling adventure, Right, and that was super fun because we all are like giant nerds who love Hobbits and Lord of the Rings, right? So we could talk about Lord of the Rings in between every round because we're like, oh, this reminds me of that, right? Right, so like you're playing this story that is separate, but it is also referential back to the thing that you really know and you really love.
Yeah, I think those are all some good points. I have moved towards a more of an appreciation for kind of established like franchise proprietary games, I guess. Partly because I think there's a lot of really good ones out there right now, and that hasn't always been the case over the decades of this hobby, but there's a lot of really good proprietary games that have really figured out how to like use their mechanics mm-hmm. to support like a particular type of experience. And I also think that when it comes to some of these genres, that kind of creativity or originality is a little overrated. yes. You know, I'm thinking of the Star Trek games I ran in, or, you know, I don't want this to be the Aliens RPG panel, but, like, that's an easy example because, you know, do you go into, like, a new Aliens movie expecting something really new? No. you know exactly what you're going to get, and all you ask for is that, like, a few details are changed around or a few minor surprises come up, but that's and I do think that only works if everyone understands that this is the kind of experience we're working together to create. But when everyone shares that understanding, I mean, you can just you know, I don't think you need to be very original.
Yeah. Oh no, not at all. Yeah, Phil, you were mentioning right before we came on about session zeros, right? And just how important those are. So are people familiar? I feel like we're using a lot of like role playing game terms, and I hope it's not going over people's heads. But maybe like, do you want to talk a little bit about session zeros, like, and how you think about them?
Yeah.
Session zero is actually session one, right? It's when your friends show up and you're like, I'm excited for this game, and like most. And, like, to be honest, campaigns sort of live and die on session 0/1. Mm-hmm. Because if your players aren't bought into the premise of your game, like, they will play it because they love getting together with you and you are a person they care about. Yeah. But, like, that and being excited about the game really keeps the momentum going from session to session. Mm-hmm. So when I do a session 0, it's usually I try to make sure that the premise of the game is incredibly fun, right? You're a vampire in occupied France drinking Hitler's blood. Like, no one says no to that. I promise. Or you are whatever the premise of the game that you're playing is, right? And so drawing on those tropes is really important. And then making sure that everyone is excited by some part of the world, especially if it's a more campaign-oriented game. In session zero, then you talk about, like, here's where we're going to start. Here's the things that are kind of around it. What would you like to see in the first time we play, right? And so building out the village that your characters live in and, like, getting the world rolling so that you have that referential, Mistborn world to like dive into right away.
Yeah.
Smaller, obviously, if it's your own campaign, but
yeah.
that's session zero in a nutshell. It's like, what are your expectations and what are you most excited about?
Great.
I don't need a mic. On the opposite side of that, I've been running a lot of one shots lately, running into not having enough time to finish. Do you have any suggestion for encompassing it all in one?
Yeah, make them two shots. I'm so bad at this. Like, I will start a one shot and then it turns into a mini campaign, and then which is fine. You also can be sort of okay with just like that's where it ended. You know, your epilogue can be a 2-minute conversation after the game, as well. So
there's two hands up, but I do want to say if you struggle with that, just you should look up Strahd Must Die.
Oh yeah.
Have you heard of it?
Heard of it.
Okay, so Strahd Must Die, for everyone else, is a Dungeons & Dragons game with a literal timer.
Yes.
You play it for 2 hours, and there's a sand clock or, like, a timer. And at the end, and at like, an hour and a half in, or maybe, I don't know, you can set the timer anyway.
It's like every half hour.
Yeah. Strahd, who is this gigantic, powerful vampire, shows up and, like, taunts you and, like, takes things away while you're trying to find ways to, like, kill Strahd. And then the last half hour is a... No matter where you are, no matter where your characters are, your players have to fight Strahd.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got an hour and a half to, like, explore his castle. And then at the hour and a half mark or whatever, he shows up and just starts trying to kill you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it really gets to the heart of pacing, and it'll help you figure out how to pace in other games as well. And then, yes.
Oh, I just
here,
real quick.
And then there. Sorry, go ahead.
Phil, I need to admit that I also turned Strahd Must Die into a two-shot. So.
How?
I'm really bad, yeah.
You're really good. That's amazing. You've defeated time.
No, yes. Yeah, like, no. It's a super fun. Absolutely everyone should check that out. If you have any love for vampires, which you can tell we do up here.
I don't want to keep step over other people's questions, but I agree with all of that. Mm-hmm. I have had, just due to life circumstances, you know, when I was a kid, you know, we would get together and play for 7 straight hours or something, and now just getting adults together. I mean, there's a hard 2-hour time limit or something like that on a game, and then we won't play again for a month. Mm-hmm. So I think Phil's advice of, like, have something ready to go to end it that isn't reliant on the players having, like, made their way through something. But I also recommend, and you hinted at this with, like, the timer of, like, bring the players in on the act of managing your time, and make it clear to them that we will be ending at 9 p.m. You know, so it's not going to be one of those awkward things where you got to keep playing later than you really want to, and just be like, I recently run a couple Star Trek games that had really tight time limits, and I would just say periodically, "This is how much time we have left." Let's move this.
It's really hard. I do see your hand. Yes.
I guess on that similar sort of note, what do you do when your players dither a bunch and they don't make a decision about where to go?
You pull out a D20 and you just roll it. Right? Like, I mean, you can have something that comes after that, but often just the act of you taking an action will get them to take an action. Yeah.
I mostly just silently seethe and feel panicky. I've gotten way better at talking, like, out of the game to players. And if we just need to hurry things up, I am better now than I used to be at saying, "Guys, we won't finish if we don't if we can't move on here." And I don't really have any great tips beyond that, but I do think there is this, like, tendency of, like, kind of over honoring, like, the game, and forgetting that, like, this game is just a fake construct we're all collectively building, and we can manipulate it, like, so.
I actually, to the person who was talking about the one shots, the one thing actually, Adventurers League, like, a good way to sort of understand pacing is also to read a lot of PFS and Adventurers League modules, because those, you know, tend to be three or four things, right? And you can sort of pace things really well. It's a good sort of way to, they're like $3 or $4. You can just go to get them and see them. So.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Yeah, good
that
idea.
Is a really good point.
The other thing is, the other thing I thought about is, there used to be this idea, concept in gaming world about giving your players sort of 3 clues to solving a problem. That has slowed down dithering at my table immensely.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And on pacing, games like Shatterdark have you actually use a real-life timer for things like torches and other things, and there's consequences when those things go out, so using real-life timers. Another strategy is the Doom Pool, which is as you're playing, every few minutes, if your players are especially dithering and arguing about what to do next, you start putting D6s into a bowl right in front of them. And when you feel like you have enough D6s in there, you roll it and you count up all the ones, and then, like, that's how bad the encounter is going to be.
Yeah.
So they see you, and once they learn that's going to happen, they'll be like, "Oh, no, we need to make a decision now."
I like that.
That's wonderful. I've used, if you're familiar with Blades in the Dark and other games like it, they use clocks. I will sometimes have an unlabeled clock out on the table that I'll periodically just fill a pie in when people are dithering. That works pretty well. I like your idea way better.
So a question I had was, do you decide, say you're going to run a campaign, do you say, "I'm going to run Pathfinder," and then decide, like, what's going to be in that world, or do you go, "I want to do this world, and I think that D&D or Fate or Pathfinder would work best for that," and, like, am I going to make my players count the number of arrows they have left in their bag and what their max lift weight is and all that? Or do you, like, how do you decide what rules you actually are really going to consider?
Do you want to start?
Yeah. I am very conservative and cautious about pitching games to the people I game with. I consider it kind of a privilege I have that they are willing to game with me and trust me as a GM. And so I do way too much thinking in advance. My situation is I have a group of people I'm playing with. So I know who I'll be playing with, and I know what they like and what they're up for. So I'll think these are the three games I personally am interested in running. Which of these systems or settings are the ones that are going to work best with these players? And then I usually give them a couple choices, what do we want to play next? Here's the three that I think would mesh well with
Session -1.
Yes. Yeah. Usually when I'm playing a game, it's because I'm excited about the game myself, right? So maybe this is the wrong way to do it. I usually don't start with the players. I usually start with the thing that I'm excited about and then try to put that out into the world, tell too many people about it, and then see sort of who says yes to it. I find that's, for me, right, if you're going to take on the mantle of running a game, right, you're still a player at the table, but you're also the one who sort of cares the most about the game too, right? So if it's going to sort of live or die based on your involvement at that point. So if there's a game system I'm excited about and I can find the players that want to play it, then becomes the frantic oh goodness, I need to learn the rules, right? So to your point about are we going to track arrows or not? Some of that's just sort of a game time decision based on what people are interested in. I did play a D&D campaign where one of the players was interested in tracking their arrows, and they were interested in naming each arrow as well too, right? So they had one, this will just stick with me forever, they named it Jessica Fletcher. All right, which is a brilliant name for an arrow, right? But it was very important for that player to go get the arrow, and every time they shot it, to get it back. That is way more interesting to me than you've shot 5 arrows, we need to go back to town to buy, 10 more arrows. So the mechanics should always support the sort of story and game experience that you want to tell, that you want to have.
Yeah, there's definitely games where knowing that you only have 4 arrows left, is a really, really adds to the experience. Yeah. So it really is is that the experience we want?
Yes, yeah.
So on the player dithering note, there's a lot of techniques have been mentioned to ramp up the pressure on the players and say, come on, guys, hurry up and make a decision. The other approach can work well, too, of saying, okay, let's take the pressure down and say, there's no right answer here. There's no gotcha if you make the wrong plan. It sounds like you've got a plan you want to roll with. Mm-hmm. Let's try it, and I'll follow you and see where it goes. So whatever they come up with is the right plan. And some of the games like Blades in the Dark or Brindlewood Bay specifically kind of reward that kind of let's try it and see sort of approach.
Yeah.
Follow up on the genre question or the franchises. Can you play Aliens with somebody who has never seen an Aliens movie? Or
yes, that is.
Can you, if you want to play Brindlewood Bay, do you have to assume a certain knowledge of Agatha Christie mysteries before it's actually going to work? Mm. So how much baseline knowledge do you need someone to have of a genre or of the tropes or of a property before you launch the game?
Yeah, it's a super good question. I think for Brindlewood Bay, I'll take that because I ran that recently, right? That's a super fun game, and definitely at least one of my players had never seen Murder, She Wrote, right? Which that's a huge touch point. Yeah, Ben's back there saying, yeah, that was me. So Brindlewood Bay, if you don't know, is a fantastic game you should all try. You are playing as a bunch of grandmotherly types who are part of a murder mystery book club, and there is a murder, an inciting event that happens within your town, and you have to go solve that mystery. So this is very Murder, She Wrote. You don't have to have watched Murder, She Wrote to play the game. I think you do need to buy into the concept, right? And so that gets back to the session zero of you as a GM need to be able to explain this world sort of enough that it's not they have to go do homework ahead of time to really understand what's going to go on in this game. So I think it's totally fine in Brindlewood Bay's case, right, to not have watched Murder, She Wrote. I think Aliens might be a little trickier because there are a lot of tropes involved in that. But I also think that if someone is up for kind of gritty sci-fi, everybody's doomed, if you can give them that pitch, they're going to like it. But also go watch Aliens because it's one of the best movies ever. So,
Yeah, I have had players. So I ran a series of Star Trek games, and there was a player who, I don't know how this is possible, but he doesn't know Star Trek at all.
Oh.
And that was a problem. And that was a mistake on my part, because what it led to was him just playing in a way that was very reasonable from his perspective, but like really clashed with like the theme. So, you know, in a Star Trek episode, you solve problems by like throwing technobabble around and you just hand wave it. It just has to sound mildly compelling enough, you know, but he was playing a more gritty in his mind. It was a more gritty problem solving with like real science.
Oh. Something like
that.
Oh, no.
I mean, it worked fine, but like that was one of my takeaways. Was like, I probably should have just had a 5-minute conversation with him and been like, this is what Star Trek is going to feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's important to make sure that people have that your players have a base to come back to whenever they're playing a genre. So it's okay if you've never seen an Aliens movie before, if you know that there are giant terrifying monstrosities that bleed acid.
Yeah.
And then, like, you're going to die to that. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the genre.
Yeah.
And that's exciting. Everyone's laughing.
Yeah.
Similarly, in Brindlewood Bay, like, no, you are an old woman, and this is a cozy game, but something terrible has happened, right? Like, that's what you need to know. So, like, when your players pause, making sure that they have enough of the genre that they can go, this sounds dumb, but it's in the canon genre. Mm-hmm. I'll just say genre like 12 times.
Yeah.
But knowing the genre is really important.
Yeah.
And to your point about Blades in the Dark, let's see where this goes. That is Blades in the Dark, if you've not read it, is a wonderful manual for like a world that exists. And it does such a good job of just giving you non-player character names and locations that you can just start rolling and then like ask your players, so what does Inspector Strahd look like? Mm-hmm. And then your players now are invested in whoever the heck Inspector Strahd is, and you literally just read that name out of page 70.
Yeah.
And having those kinds of setups, having that kind of prep work is really useful. So prep and genre bedrocks. Yes.
What do you do to help make the games like accessible for players with different like I've got ADHD, so like challenges there. But then also like I'm interested in running a game, but I'm really worried about being able to remember all of the things. Like, do you have any tips for that?
Andy does.
Thank you.
Or I know a tip that you were talking about.
Oh, go for it.
So the best thing that I did for like running long-term games came from Andy, and it was at the end of each session, record yourself talking through what happened, and then before the next session, just listen to that again. The other thing that you can do with ADHD is to make sure that the system plays nicely with your constraints. Mm-hmm. So Blades in the Dark is really great because there's no stat blocks other than the character stat blocks. And there are lots of games similar to that these days.
Mm-hmm.
Or like where the mechanic, there's a system called Dread, which uses Jenga towers for your resolution, and you pull a stick out, and like either it falls and something terrible happens, or it stays up and you don't. And so finding the system that works for you and then being excited about that story, I guess.
Yeah, to the question of like, accessibility for the players themselves. I mean, I think it's totally okay to not have sort of like one character sheet designed to rule them all, right? So like if you have players that gravitate towards sort of different ways of synthesizing information, by all means, like allow them to do that, right? Like I think like Andy, you've even mentioned this to me before too. Like if you have a player that just like can't keep their stats straight, totally fine. Get out some colored highlighters and you know, just highlight those numbers in a specific color, and you can say like, "Oh, just you know, your blue number, right?" Like, yeah, making sure that stuff sort of lines up that way. I would encourage you to try running a game, right? Like, again, if you're playing with your friends, like, you know, just see. If you're worried about like keeping track of information, again, offload that to some of the players, and also sort of be okay with like restating what the truth is to at the beginning of sessions. I've done that often, where it's like, "Okay, we haven't met in a little bit. Let's just like take a minute and like." What is true, right? Let's all agree on that. If you have your notes, great. If you don't, then like, yeah, Inspector Strahd is like, you know, he's not a vampire, right? Like we never agreed on that.
Yeah, I don't have a ton to add except to say that That's like a real concern. Mm-hmm. That's a real issue, like in my games that I run as well. And I think the thing it took me forever to learn was like, if just make sure you're running a system that isn't, that you're not having to fight the whole time. Mm-hmm. So if running D&D, if like you're always doing a ton of preparation and still feeling like you can't keep track of it or whatever, then I mean, maybe that's a sign that, I mean, there's so many games out there. There's a game that maybe gets to the experience you want and without the weight of like the rules or whatever it is that's hanging up. And I really am a big fan of offloading stuff to players. Even to the point of having like asking someone to be like a co-GM with you or to be ready to step in when you need it. So if like I can't, I've been playing D&D for like 40 years and I couldn't really tell you how like the spell or magic system memorization works or whatever. And so that's something I'm happy to say. But for other people, they have that completely internalized. So I'm happy to say I don't even want to engage with the magic system. So when someone has a magic question, mm-hmm. will you just step in and handle it? And whether maybe it's combat or something else. But
yeah, totally.
Yeah, we had years ago we ran a rogue trader game, and that's where you're traveling around space in this giant spaceship. And the like ship building rules were so far beyond my ability to engage with them. Like, you know, but one of the players, that was a really important part of the experience, is he wanted to have a ship that was custom built that had exactly the weapons and the engines and shields and stuff that he wanted. So just let go of that stuff and say, mm-hmm. you're in charge of this, and you're the expert on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hate drawing maps, but one of my players really loved it, so they became my cartographer.
Nice.
And they were always excited, and like it got to the point where we'd collaborate a little bit, and like, I need these kinds of maps. And then they showed up with them, and they... play away from the table for them was really engaging and motivating. So that was good.
Yeah, I was kind of butt in real quick there. Yeah. Like building on the maps, even like you can ask a player. I'm a big fan of asking things of players. It's good for the player and it's good for the GM. And in the Band of Blades game I'm running, there's a player. One of the characters' player class or whatever is the lore keeper, and it's like their job to remember what we did last session, not mine.
Yeah.
Like, and that's a wonderful weight off of me.
So there's a question in the very back, I think. Did I see a hand?
He's got the mic.
Okay.
Right now. Yeah.
Cool. Hi. There's a lot of talk about Blades in the Dark, mm-hmm. and I've tried to read it, and I think I'm too D&D brained mm-hmm. to get it. What do you recommend for GMs or like a game, like if running a game and for players for switching to different systems?
Yeah.
And being able to get it, yeah.
Just start playing. Sorry, for real, Blades in the Dark has a chapter called like Start Playing, and if you sit down with your group of friends and just follow that, mm-hmm. like line by line and do what it tells you to, that part of the book just solved it for me. And once I got it rolling, then I could start to explain it to people. But in a way that Dungeons & Dragons absolutely isn't, Blades in the Dark is just like a careening car that you stole. Right? Like,
yeah.
Like it's not your world, you stole it. And that's like what John Harper wants to give to people. Yeah. Just to start playing, we'll absolutely get that going. And then you'll be like, there's a little bit of like, oh, I have to look that up. And that's fine. And you can help your player, like your players can help you with that too. Yeah. So, especially for Blades in the Dark.
Yeah. And I'll say, like, I had that exact same experience with Blades in the Dark. Like, I've run that game and I love that game. The first time I read that book, I was like, what? Like, I don't understand. There's parts of that really stick out. And it is the sort of book, like, I mean, this is such a nerdy thing to say, but you have to read this 300-page book twice to really understand it. But, like, the first time I went through it, didn't really get it. Started playing it, to Phil's point, and, like, stuff started to click. The other thing with that game in particular is, like, I had to find a flow chart that someone had put together online of, like, how the dice resolution mechanic worked. And, like, that was the thing that clicked for me. So, I mean, we've mentioned, like, play away from the table a couple times here. That concept of, like, you're not at the table, but you're still sort of having fun, like, prepping and stuff. that can be a good way to approach a game system, is to say, like, how would I distill this down into, like, a one-page sheet that I can hand a player? Of, like, you know, so I'm reading this, like, I'm not really understanding, but, like, how would I try to explain this to someone? And that can help you really, like, get a handle on some of the rules and things like that.
I will second or third that Blades is a game, and its sister games are games I love, but, like, they're very difficult. They're very difficult texts, I think, to, like, just to read.
Mm-hmm. But easy to play.
That's the thing. And so sometimes just finding a good actual play just can answer the question of, like, so what is this actually supposed to look like? Because you can get really lost in the weeds of, like, trying to almost all of my Band of Blades prep is trying to understand the die. A lot of games, and Blades definitely has this, like, it's usually possible to winnow all of the complexity down to something really simple at the core. So, like, Blades in the Dark has this, like, there's a lot of ways you can manipulate and, like, a die roll, and a lot of different effects and modifiers and things like that you can bring into play. But it also explicitly, there's an explicit mechanic for, like, if you're not, it's also fine to just pick up two dice and roll them, like, and not even, and set aside the, like, complexity. Yeah. In the last Band of Blades game I ran, I didn't do that. And, like, after the game, I was thinking, like, we spent a lot of time kind of wrangling with the die thing. I should have, but that simple mechanic was right there for me the whole time, and I didn't use it.
When in doubt, roll dice.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Back and then.
Yeah, we got someone back there with the mic, and then we'll come to you.
Yeah. Hi. So, first-time caller, long-time listener. I'm curious if you're willing to share some of your, how you design your prep, how you intend your prep. I also have a attention thing going on sometimes, and I find myself lost in weeds that aren't helpful. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll be prepping entirely the wrong thing for the next session sometimes, and I was wondering if you have any particular key points you make sure you have prepped or anything like that.
Are you enjoying the prep?
Well, that's my issue.
Yeah.
To clarify, I pursue the prep I enjoy, but it isn't always the prep I need,
right.
And that causes frustration.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
So talk about sessions. Like, another thing that you can explicitly do at the end of the session is ask your players where they want to go next or what they think is going to happen next, so that you can lean into their expectations and then prepare in a way that is enjoyable to you and throw some twists at them, right? So when you're in a dungeon, you know that that dungeon is probably going to be a prescribed experience, and you can throw things at them as much as you like. But if it's an open world, and like you said, like, I prepped the quest for the blacksmith, and they spent the whole time at the tavern, right? Like, that's no good. But if you talk to your players and they're like, no, I was actually going to check out, like, the forest and that thing by the river was cool, now you know. So just, like, asking, like, offboard the direction to your players.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if I have a great answer, but a few things I'll point out is learning to trust, like, random tables and things like that is helpful. Again, it's really hard to let go of the need to plan, but in my experience, it more often than not goes just fine when you determine, like, a room, what's in a room or something like that, or what's the situation, by rolling on table and inviting the players then to, like, help you fill in the details. That's just the problem of GMing, right? Like, you're planning for something that is 100% guaranteed to miss some of what you're doing or to go awry. And I mean, the only other thing I would say is, if you think, the more you're able to think about the more you're able to think about it in terms of, like, what are the key choices that I want the players to have to make in this scenario, to keep it kind of vague. It's and then not lock yourself into a really specific incarnation of that. I think that's helpful for me, although it doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's like if you can get the basics down, right? Like this is it's hard to say like what are the basics for the game that you're running. But I mean, I think like, you know, making sure that you have sort of enough of a baseline knowledge of what you need to be comfortable with what's going to come up, I think is useful. I'm with you though. It can be really hard to know like what that is though, especially if you're distracted and you're like, I'm going to get this monster stat block, you know, exactly right. It's like, but that's not really the thing that's going to matter necessarily. Like, right, like it feels like maybe they want to talk to the blacksmith or like hang out in the tavern, and there's going to be no fighting. Yeah, so I mean, I think it's like it's hard to know what that is, but I mean, I think as if you can, you know, lean to your strengths too, right? So if you've again, like, a lot of this advice comes down to just like ask your players what they want to. But like, if you're like, I have prepped this amazing boss, that's what I have. Can we not hang out in the tavern today, right? Or like have it burst through the door, or you know, like whatever, right? Like that's okay too. Yeah.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for coming out here. This has been great.
Yeah.
I have a question concerning IDM multiple tables and multiple times a week. Is there a good way to manage all those tables without, you know, because you're juggling a bunch of things at once and trying not to lead to burnout? Because I am approaching burnout. Is there something that I can do to help mitigate? Any advice would be awesome.
Yeah. You might need to run fewer games.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really hard because like I've definitely hit that point where you're like, I am dreading this session. And it's not just like the like anxiousness about like running a session or something. It's just like, I'm not going to have fun doing this, right? And like, so again, if you are not collecting a paycheck from it, like tell your friends, can we just hang out today? Or, you know, like we need to cancel or reschedule or, you know, whatever like that. But yeah, I mean, I think so like that's one element too of it. I mean, there's probably like a perfect folder system you could set up to make it easier to like, you know, show up to the games. But I mean, I think that would be my advice is like, you know, play a little bit less, but enjoy it more when you do play.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's healthy, but I mean, role playing is maybe the only activity in my life where like I often find myself dreading. I know I'm going to have fun, but I am dreading like the game session for one reason or another. And I wish I had. I don't think I have a good answer for you because that's just a hard thing. I mean, the only thing I could say is, yeah, like, is this a net positive? You know, is it a net positive for you personally? And if not, you know, yeah, I don't know. Just be open with the players. Like, this is too much or something. Yeah.
So burnout comes from, I've been doing a lot of reading on this recently, actually. Burnout happens when pressure turns into stress, and stress happens when you don't have the necessary resources to feel like you are doing a good job. And this comes from Mo Gawat's podcast, Unstressable. So plug the ex-CEO of Google at a TTRPG thing. So looking at places where you can find more resources or gather more resources from, which goes back to offloading things to your players and giving them roles that they're excited about might help you. And then also finding other places to take some of the prep work away from what you're doing would be useful maybe. So if you're, yeah, and this goes all the way back to the beginning of like run a session or if you're doing it like in an Adventurers League style, you don't always have to run new things. You can just run the same adventure again and give them different pre-gens, things like that. If people are showing up to play your games, great. And then whatever keeps it fresh, but that you've already got in your mind so that you don't have to spend resources you don't have and get burned out.
Phil, you had actual expertise there, and yet you waited for me and Chris to blather through our
questions. I feel like we walked into your trap.
We've got time for one more question.
Okay. I know that the first response to this question is going to be have a conversation with your players beforehand.
Yeah.
But my friend here will remember, perhaps with some amount of trauma, that I ran a World of Darkness, like kind of Chronicles of Darkness game a few years ago. And one of despite my best efforts to communicate the genre of how kind of horrendous some of these games can be, one of my players walked in with a mage who was just like essentially a human version of a Sparkle Wizard. Uh-huh. And when World of Darkness things started happening, there was this sort of shock moment. Mm. What kind of ways would you have to sort of rectify, like, if you realize, like, oh, I'm several sessions in and, like, some of my players are, like, essentially have been excerpts from a different genre or something like that? What, you know, would you have them leave or, like, not leave, but, like, revise? Or how would you approach that sort of thing if you realized later on?
I'm thinking.
Okay. I'll vamp while he's thinking about the correct answer here. Yeah, I think the you're right. You know, talking to the player right is sort of the right approach there. I mean, it's a really interesting thing. I mean, I think it gets a little bit back to session zero, a little bit back to sort of like a lines and veils discussion. If you've heard of those things, right? So talking about sort of like what you're okay seeing happen, what shouldn't happen at all, right? So like you didn't do that, whatever, that's fine. Like yeah, so you're in there. If you can talk to the player, great. If not, I mean, one approach is like, can I modify the game, right? Is this someone that I want to play with, right? Like, is there a way to modify this game or to bring them along to like sort of balance the darkness that's happening? If that's still not okay, I mean, it is also okay not to play with everybody that you want to play with, right? Like, you can talk to the player again, get outside of the game and say like, it sounds like or it feels like this is not the sort of the game for you. Do you want to set this one out, you know, or do you want to revise your character, like what you were saying?
I think, yeah. When I'm running longer campaigns, I am pretty explicit about making about having like not a trial period, but I'll state that I would like to run whatever. I'd like to run all the way through Ravenloft this year. Let's all commit to like 3 game sessions, and then evaluate if we want to continue. And like that's a natural off ramp for anyone for whom there's a miscommunication or something like that. And it's you have an easy out if you need to either say this game is going in a direction that doesn't seem like it quite meshes with what you want, or just to say, this isn't, if that's too awkward or too stressful, you can also this didn't work out. Thanks for playing through we completed the 3 trial sessions that I wanted to do, and let's do something else.
Yeah. Those are the meta things. I avoid trauma at the table by using a spreadsheet. That or a anonymous chat tool, and I don't start play. If I'm playing with new people, right, Adventurers League, I don't start playing until I see that there are X number of anonymous people in that chat room equal to my players, so that everyone is in there, but they're anonymous. And so this gets then to the X card, which is it's a card on the table, and if someone taps it, like you rewind and whatever just happened didn't happen, and then you continue with the narrative. So that would be, going forward, a safety tool I would use would be like something where someone can just be looking at their phone and then anonymously something comes up. Like that's fine. Comment in the front.
What specific thing do you use?
Yeah, so I just use a Google Sheet that only has one cell, and I make it available to anyone with the link. And so then I keep that on my phone, and if I get a notification like the cell popped up, like that's how I do it.
That's great. It's really good.
Well, I'm sorry we're out of time for this panel. I want to thank you all so much. So Phil and Chris and Andy, this has been absolutely wonderful. Thank you.
I had fun.
Thank you.
I hope you
all did.
I would also like to invite you, if you are a GM and want to run a game next year at the convention, you can see Marissa, who's right back in the doorway, and she can take some contact information from you. So we've got a full day planned. Thank you all so much for coming.
Yeah,
it's a blast.
Thanks, everyone.
Come play. Yeah.